And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Now, Corey, we had you on Solidarity Breakfast for a while. We were lucky.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get on to Solidarity Breakfast?
When I was very early to the station, I was talking to Bill during a Monday reception shift. He was before me. Previous to that, we'd sort of bonded because we were both Trotskyists who hated other Trotskyists. So that was nice. So we got to talking, and Bill found out that I knew about how to make websites. And so he thought that I would be useful for Solidarity Breakfast to make the website. And, you know, more or less, we politically agreed. So he asked me to come on to the show. And at that time, I was really, really, really sick of old white men of the left and the way that they treated me. So I really got in his face about it. I was like, all right, I'll go on the show on the condition that, you know, you don't patronize me, you don't talk over me, you don't take me for granted, you know, all this sort of jazz. And he actually just put up with that. He agreed to that and was actually, you know, not a jerk, which, so yeah, he was actually a pleasure to work with.
And it was obviously a shock, just like it was a shock for everybody else that Bill should pass away so quickly.
Mm.
Can you reflect on your feelings about this?
Oh, it's just the worst. Like, I actually hadn't realised that anything was wrong. So I talked to him on Monday, and then he obviously had the heart attack on Monday night. And but nobody actually told me about this. And on Monday, we'd organised to do an interview together with one of the Hong Kong protesters. So I waited around till 8:30 on Wednesday night, you know, and I was still like, ah, that bloody bastard, you know, all that sort of thing. You know, where is he? But when he still hadn't answered my calls by Thursday morning, I was starting to worry. And yeah, so I came into 3CR and I asked someone at reception and I found out. And it was just such a, yeah, it was just awful. And at first I really wanted to believe that he wasn't going to die. I made him a get well card. I just didn't want to believe it.
3CR is sad to announce our much-loved comrade Bill Della passed away peacefully early this morning. His daughter Taya, partner Sydney, and good friend Uncle Larry Walsh were at his side. Everyone at 3CR is feeling deeply the loss of our dear comrade Bill. We will keep friends and supporters notified about details for memorial service at Trades Hall. The flag is flying at half-mast at Trades Hall today for Bill.
Hello, my name's Robbie Thorpe. I do Fire First and The Alternative at 3CR Community Radio. And just last week we lost our deadly brother Bill, you know, who I've really come to know over the last, particularly over the last 12 months. I've got to know Bill very closely. And I'd just like to send my condolences and deepest sympathies to his family and friends. We're all going to miss him here, and he's like part of the furniture. I think he's left a big void here. And, yeah, I just want to say that we're going to miss Bill a lot here, and I'm sure everyone else as well.
Today's Solidarity Breakfast listener is a tribute to Bill Della, who I was the co-host of this program, Solidarity Breakfast, and today in its present incarnation. I'm joined by Lynn Beaton and Lita Chalala, friends and comrades of Big Bill Della, or Sweet William, depending on how you wish to refer to him. Hello, you two.
Hello.
Now, Lynn, you've got a particular sort of perspective on Bill. You're going to give us a little bit of a rundown of his history.
Yeah, I'll just start. I'd like to start by just extending my greetings to absolutely all of you who are listening and who are feeling a bit like I'm feeling, which is still very sad at the loss of our dear friend and comrade, but also learning day by day how much to appreciate the wonderful legacy that he left behind. So I just thought, you know, if we could start with a little bit about his birth in country Victoria. He was the youngest of five children, and his parents at the time, his father was share farming, but then when he was about five, the share farming ended because the family relationship that depended on broke down. And so the family moved to Geelong, and they lived in sort of in an outer suburb of Geelong with a great big block of land where they grew veggies and had chooks and had a sort of, you know, semi-little farmlet. And so Bill grew up in that environment, and he was a very, very, you know, I don't suppose it comes as a surprise to any of us, he was very popular at school. He won a cup for being the best debater in the school. And he was also, I don't know if people know, but he was a good sportsman, you know. He loved football and cricket and played all those things avidly and enjoyed that. And but then, anyway, at the end of school, he went off to La Trobe University. He was the first member of his family to go to university. His sister said to me, he was always the cleverest, but it's also true that none of us also had the opportunity to go because, you know, life didn't allow it until Bill came along. And of course, one of the things that we're aware of right now is that when Bill came along, Gough Whitlam had introduced, or the Labor government had introduced free education, a free university education. Anyway, so Bill went to La Trobe Uni, became...
So he was
a smart working class boy, absolutely. And became very quickly politicised by the university activities. But then he sort of got disillusioned with university, and he didn't. I think there was, you know, there was a lot of stricture in the university. And he decided that he wanted to go off to West Australia and work in the mines. And this, remember, is in the mid-1970s. So it's a long time before West Australia and the mining boom, you know, it was the first mining boom. And so very quickly, Bill being Bill, he decided that the union, the conditions of the miners out in the desert were absolutely shocking. And he started to work with a guy called Des Tutnam, who I hope will ring in a little while, and they started to organise miners. Now, there's this amazing image of Bill, because Bill was a child of his time. So in the mid-70s, he had waist-length hair, a great big beard.
And in fact, it's quite fascinating to look at some of these early shots of Bill.
Yeah.
He's got this, not only was he a babe, a 70s babe, but he had a long beard that looked like something that stepped out of a 19th century photograph. Fantastic.
And he used to wear, you know, overalls that were tie-dyed.
In the middle of the desert.
In the middle of the desert, organising miners.
Yeah.
So
he wasn't going to disappear into the sand.
No. And his a lot of his organisation was early, very early organisation around the understanding that fly in, fly out was a you know, a health hazard for miners and for their families, and so he fought against that. He fought for you know, accommodation to be provided for families so that whole families could move into the areas and so on. Then he moved down to Perth and worked setting up trade union training at the Perth Trades and Labour Council. And as far as we know, that was the actual first trade union training courses that were set up by Trades and Labour Councils in Australia. And that course in Western Australia directly led to the establishment of TUTA, which became the National Trade Union Training Authority, as a lot of people will know, or some people not. And TUTA was right through the 80s and 90s and a major part of trade union life that people who were coming up through trade unions and showing themselves as militants would go off to tutor for live-in courses.
But basically what he was doing in that respect was working towards a educated future for working class people within the union framework.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. And he one of the things that was a lifelong prize for Bill was the whole question of providing education and so and giving people information in order to empower them.
Yep. That's the philosophy he always followed, that empowerment of the working class. And he never disrespected anyone. And if there was something positive in the person, he worked on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that, you know, if you look at everything he did, because the next thing he did then was that he when he was in Perth, I have to say, he joined an organisation at the time called the Socialist Labour League. And that was at the time that he became a Trotskyist. The Socialist Labour League, however, was a tight, narrow, sectarian organisation. And it took Bill was absolutely fascinated by the ideas. He was empowered by the notion that he was working with other people in order to build a revolutionary movement that would bring socialism to the world. He was absolutely committed to internationalism. He was absolutely committed to the idea of, you know, socialism as the way to empower everybody and give everybody equal opportunity, basically. And But then he had to leave that organisation because the organisation, whilst it had fabulous ideas and a fabulous objective, if you like, its practices were narrow and sectarian, and that was completely antipathetic to Bill's nature. Bill's right. Not sectarian at all. So he didn't stay very long in that organisation. Well, he stayed, I don't know, about 5 years, I think. And then he came to Melbourne and decided he wasn't going to be political.
Oh, you're right.
At that point, he met Catherine and Taya. Taya was a tiny little girl, and so him and Catherine got married. He adopted Taya and became, you know, the proudest dad that you could ever imagine of his little girl. I've, you know, watched him alongside Taya growing up and watched his smiles so many times as he brags to me about Taya's latest, you know, what Taya's right. done now.
She's the smartest girl in the world.
Yes, exactly. and you know, he was never wrong. Whenever I met Taya, I found that, you know, that was true. I sort of met him around this time because he, despite himself, was working in his union, which was the VPSA. He was working in the education department. You see, again, he's involved in training.
And for those who don't know what VPSA is, Victorian Public Service Association.
Thank you.
It's roll off the
Because
the
it's acronym. Now it's now morphed into the CPSU.
That's right. And even
there was SPSF before that.
I was just going to say in between it was SPSF, which rolls off our tongues because we both work there, Lalitha
right.
and I. But, So, anyway, he was becoming involved in the union, and people, obviously his workmates and colleagues, could see his potential. It's just impossible for Bill to hide that potential, as everyone who knows him
can't
knows.
Help himself.
and so people were putting pressure on him to, you know, because the union was rotten and right-wing and self-satisfied and self-gratifying.
And self-serving.
And self-serving, thank you.
You're seeking for that
I
word.
I was seeking for that word, you're right.
And also they didn't respond to members' needs. Oh, yeah,
and that
was across the board, not just SPS or VPSA at that time, even the ANF before that, RANF, you know,
that was
so
perceived, many of them. That was the perceived notion about that union.
Around the traps, majority of the unions were bound down by the accord, and they weren't able to wriggle out of that agreement. And Bill Gett came into the union, in the 90s?
They got elected, yes.
Yeah,
they did get elected to leadership. So Bill basically organised with a whole lot of other people to set up a ticket in the end to run. But before he did that, just coincidentally, in the funny way that life is, contact was made between Andy Blunden and Bill and myself. And we all had the same background. We had all been involved in this Socialist Labour League, and we'd all left it for various reasons, pretty much the same reason, because it was sectarian, and we realised that was just stupid and was going to go nowhere. But we all had ideas in common about socialism, about and about not non-sectarian. We'd seen what sectarianism did, and so we were all completely non-sectarian. And we set about trying to unite, you know, the left as we saw it, and the left for us included, you know, Greens and Blacks and everybody who was struggling.
Or what Bill would call the progressive side of politics.
Yeah, the progressive side of politics. And so that ticket that was put together won the election, and Bill became the vice president of the BPSA, and it was very Bill that he didn't put himself up at the front of the ticket.
Was it vice secretary or vice president?
President. Did I say secretary?
No, I was thinking it was secretary.
No, he was the vice president. Okay. Because the, yeah.
And it wasn't his natural inclination to put himself at the top of the ticket.
Well, it was the opposite, really. People wanted him at the top of the ticket, and he wouldn't do it. You know.
And why, do you think?
I think that for all of, you know, Bill's apparent confidence, he had a lot of self-doubt. And that's, of course, what made him the wonderful person that he was. You know, Corey was talking in her introduction about, you know, saying to him that, you know, I'm not going to work with you if you're going to be a man of your age and talk over me and do this and do this. And he says, oh, and that's part of Bill's humility.
He's also, in a way, shy. He's got that side to people don't often see. Yes. You know, I knew that later on.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So, and I went and worked with him at the VPSA, you know, as a paid employee, and doing all the publications and so on. And really, the breadth of that Bill had in his vision, he was working with public service members, and they hadn't been in the leadership for very long when Kennett was elected, and that created a crisis in that union because Kennett. Because the union covered Victorian public servants, you know, who were the workers that Kennett first attacked, and
it raised the argument that people in Victorian unions should try and amalgamate with the ones that go under the federal award.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
union?
No.
No.
Because.
So what happened?
Well, the first thing that happened is that Kennett. One of the very first acts that the very first things that he did was he stopped payroll deductions. And so what that meant is that one day that union had 33,000 members and the next day it had none. It had to go out and basically recruit everyone back to membership. Now, it didn't mean convincing necessarily people to rejoin, but it did mean working out a payment method. It didn't have the capability to go around the workplaces and collect the dues.
No, of course not.
Back in those days, I don't know if people can believe this now, but back in those days, people were incredibly nervous and shy about doing, about giving an authority for there to
bank
be...
Bank deductions.
Yes, a bank. Remember that, Lalitha?
Yes, they didn't trust technology. And they said, no, we can't do that. It's automatic deduction is not something I want to do. And it was tough because I was employed as an organizer in 1990, come 91, and it was hard work. It was really, really hard because we lost 50% of the membership. Money was on the gurgler. We had no income.
We had no income.
Or very little income.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bill took on the task of motivating, supporting all the organisers to go out and recruit. Yeah. That was the main task in the immediate future at that time when we were in there. And a lot of people really struggled with that. It was really hard.
It was really hard.
Yeah, that was the biggest weapon Kennett had to attack our union because he wanted to cut back the... the workers, I mean, he was, as they're doing now, reducing the number of public servants. Mm. That's what it was.
So at the time, you know, Bill was Bill, you know, and he did a lot of press statements. And I think the famous thing that he did was he said, and it was splashed all over the front page of newspapers, that there will be blood on the streets. But there wasn't blood on the streets. But my goodness, there was a lot of feet on the streets. There was... thousands and thousands, and you know, I think there's a lot of people who can take credit for the organisation of those rallies. Yeah. But there was us at the VPSA, by then it was called the SPSF,
State Public Service Federation.
All of us, and we made a massive contribution. We had members who had almost all of our members. There was hardly any of the, you know, they're state public servants.
Yes.
Hardly any of them had ever dreamed that they would put their feet on the streets in a demonstration. They thought it was a dreadful, terrible, only rabble people did that. But we got, I don't know, do you know what percentage, Lalitha?
At least 50, 60%.
Absolutely enormous outpouring people coming out. And
did you put that down to Bill's enthusiasm and coaching of the stewards going out there?
I think, you know, you can't really give credit to one person. It would be like for you to say that it would be for someone in 20 years' time to say, and do you think the success of 3CR was because Bill Della was such a wonderful? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it would be against Bill's philosophy. Bill believes so much in the membership participating in the decision making process and all that. I think it's a combination of things. One is the attack by Canada, which infuriated all the public servants. Their livelihood was going down the gurgler, and that radicalized them. And I think it's timely having Bill there as one of the leaders who led that fight against Kennett. I think that combination worked really well.
He played a role. He played an important role. I
was just thinking that, you know, when you're up against it and people are unfamiliar and they lose confidence, having someone who will inspire them just at the right moment can be key.
Yeah, it's like Irene being the 86. It's just the right people at the right time.
Don't give up.
On.
We can do it.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Dare to fight.
Absolutely. We set up a committee. The committee was the committee was open to all members. The difficulty was that we did a lot of this with enormous opposition from within. There were ranks of people who'd been part of Built the Ticket, the same ticket Bill had been on. But actually, once we got in and we were like, let's have democracy here. Let's open up. Mm. Let's have a meeting every night at 5 o'clock so that members can come and we can talk about our strategies for fighting Kennett. And you know, inside the union, the people who fought against that. So that was a big battle.
I think we've got to remember that our membership in SBSF at that time composed of a lot of the higher ranking public servants as well, who took some of the leadership role.
That's right.
And they're all white collar workers. You know, that middle class flavour was right through the union during that time.
But not just that, public servants.
Public I wouldn't put them down.
No, I'm not
people.
Putting them. No, I'm not putting them down. No, but being in a public service means that you work on long term strategies in a slower pace than direct action.
I don't know
about that either. I think the other thing that's also true, what Lalitha says is true, that you know some of the people on the ticket fill that bill, but also inside the union, when they won, there was a whole staff. You know, I think there was something like. Was it 250 staff? It was a big union.
It had a lot of staff.
And those staff had been trained by what I will call for short, just to make it short, a big, fat, lazy mob. And they resented the members. They didn't have to go out and talk to them very often because they got payroll deductions rolling in. And so the money just rolled in every month. And
they got their pay and they went home.
Yeah, that's right. And so suddenly there's us mad, wild Trotskyists.
Wanting to make them work. They really make them work for their money, for their salary. They didn't like it. And, of course, Bill, you know, when the leadership changed over, there was a lot of the right-wing mob who were there before had left. So there was a rump that stayed. So then Bill employed all the left-wing mad people like myself and beat me the crowd. So we were his support in a way. And he was incredibly supportive. I mean, there's an organizer called Ariel, and Ariel and I used to go out and make lots of trouble out in the field. And he always came and said, what have you two terrible twins been up to today? You know, it was a daily ritual. But it was fun working with Bill. You know, you can have a joke, you can go out, work hard, come back, and know that you're fully supported in your work.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the best thing employers can do, you know, because he was my employee in a sense. But the enthusiasm, the encouragement, the support he gave everyone who worked there was inspiring. It was just amazing. You know, it was a pleasure to work in that union at that time in Buell. And Kay McVeigh was the president.
Kay was the president, yeah.
President, yeah.
And Kay was good too.
You're on 3CR and we're doing a tribute show to Bill Della, who recently died very suddenly and has left quite a hole in people's hearts in 3CR's community and many other community as well. And we've got Lynn Beaton in the studio and Lali. Chalaya,
thank you.
Sorry.
Just say Lali, don't worry about Chalaya a bit.
Yeah. Okay, and Lali, who are comrades of Bill from a long way back, and they're giving us a vivid history of his involvement in the PPS?
No, SBSF.
Well, we've now moved on.
State Public Services Union.
We've now moved on.
The State Public Services
History
Union.
Moves.
So, and one of the other things that I think is really important to mention, and that is the breadth. So we were in this battle with Kennett, which was mighty, which was vicious, and it was internally vicious as well as externally vicious.
Yes.
We were fighting outside against Kennett, and inside we were fighting against the right wing of a traditionally right wing union. Mm. But Bill still had the vision, so that one day Bill was on Radio National talking about, you know, the anti-Kennett campaigns and why he thought it was important, you know, and all of a sudden he gets a phone call at the office from a farmer who's involved in an organisation called Bankwatch, who were organising against banks for foreclosing on the farms.
That's right. Yeah.
And he says, I can't believe this, that you're a unionist, he said, but I agreed with pretty much everything you said. And so Bill said, oh, great, let's have a meeting. So the next thing we know, Bill's off to the Air Peninsula, you know, to meet with the Bankwatch people. And after that, there was a bit of an alliance was set up for a while between, you know, the sections, well, the Bill's Bill, really.
So what you're saying is that Bill took opportunity, he saw opportunity, yes. And this reinforces his non-sectarian approach.
Yeah, but one of the things that Bill copped was at that time, the question was raised, what have the farmers to do with the SPSF? So that,
yeah, and also right. there's that was, a certain right. amount of anger amongst some people about farmers turning on union actions over years.
Yeah. So they've never been allies in the past, and it's the first time I think Bill was able to make a union farmer even meeting to start discussing issues. It's like the Greens and the timber workers, you know, they have a lot in common, and yet they were not able to sit down calmly to talk about issues that you can resolve to the benefit of society and workers. And that's what Bill was trying to do.
Yeah, you know, it's directly similar to what's going on with Friends of the Earth and farmers affected by fracking.
Exactly. And Bill copped it. You know, Bill copped it to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But that didn't stop him. Being political, I think he brought politics into the union. That's one of the major things. Kay was in it as well. Because Kay was a similar group with Kay.
Mm.
So he brought politics in. He brought the liaison with the farmers in. He was doing a lot of political work.
He's very brave from the fellow, union. Really. Very brave fellow.
That's him. Though. That's nothing could stop him. When Bill goes, Bill goes. You can't stop him.
No, but the thing is that, you know, when I look back on that farmers thing, it was fantastic. I can remember actually going to Swan Hill one time to speak at a Bankwatch meeting. And there was all the Bankwatch speakers. And, you know, they were Country Party right-wing people. But they were pissed off with the Country Party because it wasn't, you know, they were like we are at the moment about the Labor Party. You know, why is it not doing anything for us? But I can remember... And then came my turn to speak, and when I got up and said that I was from the Victorian Public Services Union, a whole heap of people turned their backs and started to walk away. And I said, I understand how this town's feeling, because something had just closed down. Because I grew up in a small country town in New South Wales that had an abattoir, and I remember when the abattoir closed, and they sort of stopped, and they pricked up their ears. And so it's just a question of making a bridge.
Yes.
They didn't want to listen to a unionist until I said, I grew up in the country and I remember when the abattoirs in my town closed down, that suddenly there was a bridge, and then they listened. And that, you know, that was me. You know, Bill did those sort of things a hundredfold. But I think one of the interesting lessons for us is why did that not develop further? And in a sense it was because, I don't know, was it ahead of its time? There was so much opposition to it on both sides. The farmers who were involved with us were being told they were mad by their mates, and we were being told we were mad by our mates. And so it didn't anyway eventuate, and then what did eventuate was that people who had stood on the original ticket with Bill stabbed him in the back and stabbed Kay in the back and stood against them at the next election and won the next election because they got the Labor Party behind them.
That's right.
The Labor Party poured money into making sure that Kay McVeigh and Bill Della were outed.
Yeah,
and so that happened. So
and they had a lot of support from inside the union as well.
Before we move on to the next stage of Bill's history, in his just before he died, one of his incarnations was as a 3CR broadcaster, and of course this program is in tribute to Bill. He was the mastermind behind the latest version of Solidarity Breakfast. And of course, Solidarity Breakfast has got a long history. It's been going for about 30 years and was originally a Bill Hartley. It must be the Bills.
The Bills.
It's the Bills.
Something about the Bills.
A Bill Hartley vehicle. And of course, it will have wheels after Bill, but that is purely because the show must go on. And before I let the two fabulous people that are in the studio continue to talk about Bill's history, I'll just want to play you something that with Bill interviewing a person that he was in awe of.
Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah.
We're inviting callers to call in.
Oh, yes, of course.
And we need to give out the number.
Yeah, okay. The number is 9419 8377. If you want to reflect on Bill, if you've got something to share, that's 9419 8377. You can SMS on 0488 930 855. That's 0488 930 855. Yeah, sure. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you.
Talking to Billy Bragg on Radio 3CR, let me say that you do carry that banner of Woody Guthrie extraordinarily well, and it's a great pleasure to have you talking to community radio.
Good to be here, really good to be here.
In your commentary this morning, you were talking about the situation at home, and you've just come through a period where the Leveson Inquiry has exposed a serious number of criminal activities on the part of the press, liaisons with the police and so on. Do you think there's a bigger crime in there, however, that says that it was the Murdoch Empire that owned every government since Thatcher?
Well, there's that problem, and shamefully, our politicians at home are far too close to Murdoch. And hopefully the situation we have now with the Leveson Inquiry will expose that and stop it happening, hopefully.
Hopefully, but regulation may not be the answer?
I think the key word in the 21st century is accountability. And people want accountability. They want people in power to be held to account, and that includes Rupert Murdoch.
And that also, you said during your commentary to the meeting this morning, that the Occupy movement has got some lessons to learn in terms of organising.
I think they can show us the way, but I think they know that ultimately they're going to have to organise. You know, I mean, that's the bottom line. I think they know that. I mean, I think they do a great job, and I think the challenge of articulating the compassionate ideals that are at the heart of socialism, they're doing a good job of it, and I have a lot of respect for them. But they, you know, however you want to change the world, fundamentally you've got to organise. Only the audience can change the world, not the singer-songwriter, not the radio station, not the DJ, but the audience, these people here.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Love you to death.
So that was Billy Bragg, as interviewed by Bill Della at the National Union of Workers protest against insecure work at Southern Cross Station in Melbourne late last week. So I have to say, Bill, I've never seen you so starstruck as you were talking to Billy.
Absolutely. Well, he's a hero. I mean, he's one of the few people who have had the opportunity to make a fortune out of their life skills and has continued to remain a principled supporter of the struggle for overcoming oppression and for the rights of workers and the rights of oppressed peoples everywhere. Yeah, I mean, the point he made, I think, during the evening concert was that people like The Clash were equally inspired by Woody Guthrie, as was Bruce Springsteen in America, as were, of course, Pete Seeger and the Weavers and that whole protest generation, Joan Baez. All of those people were clearly inspired by the work of Woody Guthrie. And, I mean, when he sings songs, he sings a song dedicated to Pretty Boy Floyd, who was an outlaw. And one of the great lines of all time in music for me was, some people rob you with a six-gun, others do it with a fountain pen. And, you know, nothing could be more apposite than today. You know, I mean, bank robbers get 10, 15 years jail. Where's any banker in jail anywhere in the world as a result of the criminal activities that they were engaged in the lead-up to the financial crash in 2007 and 8? Those points should never be lost, you know. The fact that Pretty Boy Floyd would, at Christmas time, distribute monies from his ill-gotten gains to the poorest folk in towns was, again, another side of that commitment, that solidarity that exists amongst oppressed layers that, again, only a Woody Guthrie could draw out and bring together. So you could see, you know, that whilst some people are reduced to criminality as a means of survival, nevertheless there remains a solidarity with other oppressed peoples, and you don't get gangsters robbing poor folk. So there is a just an element of justice and a fight for justice that's contained in all of that. And Woody and the Dust Bowl. I mean, people have forgotten the Dust Bowl, but if you read any John Steinbeck, you get an impression of what America was like. If you read about Clarence Darrow and others, you see that wonderful, rich history of the radical nature of American politics in the 20s. It's completely disappeared, where anarchists, communists, socialists, radical trade unionists were all fighting together for social justice and for equality. Woody Guthrie was at the heart of that, you know, and so for Billy Bragg to continue in that tradition. And even Springsteen at the recent South by Southwest Festival made an appeal to musicians to stand up and play their part politically. Again, the same tradition says, whilst singer-songwriters aren't going to change the world, they can certainly make a contribution to a better understanding and an ease of access to an understanding for generations who don't read theory and who don't understand deep and complex political matters. The worst period in all of our histories has to be the Reagan-Thatcher period. It was the period in which finance capital came to complete domination, where any notion of solidarity and community were thrown out the door, and Ayn Rand rose supreme. You know, and if you've not read Ayn Rand, then people ought to, because it's a terrifying thought to think that, you know, individualism is going to triumph over communal aspirations at every level. And so when Blair came along, to a lesser extent than when Obama came along, I mean, if Obama had gone to a worldwide election, he'd have been elected by 75 or 80% or more of the world's population, who saw in the notion of hope a black man offering something that had never been offered before. Now, that means just means that the betrayal that he's enacted is even greater than Blair's was for Billy Bragg, but nevertheless parallel journeys. And so in Australia we had it all around the wrong way. It was our Labor government under Hawke and Keating who delivered the Thatcherite freeing up of finance capital, who deregulated the banks, who started the sale of what used to be our own airline, our own bank, our own insurance companies, all those things that we used to own. So the privatisation process was undertaken by a Labor government in Australia, and so there was a massive amount of confusion that meant that when we came to our Billy Bragg moment in 96 with the prospect of Blair, and in our case Rudd, who sounded a lot like Blair actually, and who had actually adopted a similar Christian-styled socialism, based himself on Bonhoeffer and the left progressive church, did cause heartache for lots of people, because, again, you want to get rid of the reactionaries, but you'd hope for something better. and that's been the revelation, in a sense, in the last 20 years, is that every time you elect what you think you're going to be something better, you get betrayed.
You're on 3CR with Annie and Lynn and Lali, and we're commemorating the passing of Big Bill, Big Bill Della, or Sweet William, depending on which incarnation you wish to direct your thoughts to. Bill died recently, very swiftly, no pain, but deeply shocking, and of course the pain is left in other people's hearts. But you two were just talking. We got to the point when they got stabbed in the back. This is like Shakespeare.
It was like Shakespeare. It was really exactly like that. They're best friends.
Oh, how shocking!
Ganged up. Well, you know, not their best friends. You know, but you know, they're people that they stood, their colleagues that they stood on a ticket with, against this massive, great, big, established, long-term right-wing leadership, and the worst of it was that when. That in the discussions for, you know, the elections are coming up, there's discussions about the ticket, and the people who were planning to run a separate ticket did not declare their hand until the very, very last minute, which meant that they were involved with the discussions with Bill and Kay and so on about the ticket. And so they knew exactly what Bill and Kay had in mind because they hadn't declared their hand. And at the last minute, it was all nasty. It was all Shakespearean. It was all disgusting. And it broke Bill's heart. I think it broke a lot of hearts.
Yes.
But, you know, it was one of those times. I think Bill's heart was broken. I have to say, you know, I think Bill's heart was broken several times in his life. And I think it was because he was so incredibly enthusiastic and eager that he sort of thought other people were too, and he thought other people had the same motive as him, which was actually to cause, you know, the improvement in the human condition. And that's what Bill was all about. And he sort of thought other people were about that too, but actually it's a very sad thing to say, but a lot of other people are only about the improvement in their own condition.
That's right.
At the expense of other people.
Did he adjust his strategy? Because he didn't shy off his own political view. Did he adjust to this new understanding or this devastating understanding of other people?
I don't think so.
No,
he was very trusting. He was very trusting, and he would put all his energy into explaining the things about politics to young people who wanted to know. And the other enormous talent he had was how he related to everybody, regardless of age. Like my son. You know, he's one person my son could relate to. And he won't talk to too many white adult males. But my son was devastated when I told him that Bill passed away. So it's his ability to engage and be relevant, be engaging to people of any age. He trusted people, and I think that's part of his romanticism, the romantic part of any revolutionary. Really, you trust people, and you think, you know, you've got to be human. You must believe in basic human rights, and he could relate to that. But in what goes on his mind is not always what goes on the other person's mind. Like Karen Batt, who stood against Bill in the SPSV election, he trusted, you know, and he trusted. She stood on his ticket before, and then she stabbed him in the back. So his trust was betrayed, and he does get heartbroken. But you know, he moved on. He said, okay, we're going to trust another person. You know, you keep trying and trying and trying. That's the broader global aspect he had. You throw the net wide. You will get some people you can join who you can trust and you can work with. He always had good, loyal friends around him.
Because the fight was too important.
Yes, the overall struggle was over and above these petty criminals, as I call them.
Absolutely. But you know, I think that...
That was an expressed opinion from Lali.
I think that, you know, yes. I think that it's not that he didn't learn the lesson. I think he did know. He took the lesson on board. But he did with it was say, it's not going to stop me from trusting people. It just means I know that they might cave at any point. Mm. Any person might cave in. For all sorts of reasons, and so I'll work with whoever I can for whenever I can, and if that working relationship falls by the way for reason, I will just continue, and that person will fall by the wayside.
Yeah. I should mention that if you want to be part of a public formal memorial to Bill Della, it is going to be held at Trades Hall in a corner of Lygon and Victoria Street in Carlton. On the
8th of November.
8th of November at 2 p.m. So put that in your books, in your diary, and come along because I'm sure there will be this facility of Bill's to spread his net wide will indeed show it fruit at this memorial.
Mm. Mm. There's so many people on Facebook who are heartbroken, and I've been reading it. I'm thinking, the number of people whom he has touched is amazing.
It is amazing.
It's amazing. It is.
Well, we might hear from one of those people right now. You've known Bill for a fairly long time, haven't you, Jacob?
Well, I've been in Melbourne for 17 years. And I met Bill as soon as I came to Melbourne. I'd met him once or twice visiting Melbourne over the years, just in meetings, and, you know, we had mutual friends. But I guess in the last 17 years, I've known him reasonably closely, yeah.
Yeah, so what's your major feelings about Bill?
Geez, it's so hard because he was so full of contradictions in a lot of way. While I know that in his youth he was a Healyite and different things, he wasn't a joiner. He was always interested in working with as broad as possible a group of people. But also he had, I guess, which is unusual on the far left in Melbourne, and he had a, I suppose you'd call it almost an Australian larrikinism that was endearing. He could up front and call a fuckwit, regardless of gender, race or political affiliation or age or anything. He was genuine. He wasn't bound by party principles or organisational structures. He said what he thought. He worked with people across a range of organisations. He could be just as comfortable talking to people within the Catholic Church hierarchy one day and far left trots the next afternoon, sort of thing. So I guess the overall impression I have of Bill is someone whose politics, not his politics, because his politics are fairly tight, but whose activist life was as broad as his character. Mm. He moved across a range of sectors. He moved across a range of campaigns. Often people, for example, in the Indigenous campaign would be unaware of how deeply he was involved in, say, the aspect of an environmental campaign. Or I was talking to some young greedy types the other day who had no idea about his work with the CPSU and had no idea that he was actually a trot because he didn't espouse things in that way, you know? So he was a broad, genuine human being, I guess, is the best I can say. Not the best way I can put it.
Now, you say his politics were tight. What do you mean?
Well, I was going to say his politics were broad, and corrected myself. They were broad in as much as, I bet he would work a range across sectors. But when I say he has tight politics, I mean to say he knew what was right. He had a political framework. He had a political philosophy. And everything he did worked within that framework and philosophy. He had his own set of political philosophy, and he worked very tightly within that. That enabled him to work with a broader range of community as possible.
You were laughing a couple of weeks ago, you said, about being each other's pallbearers.
Well, not quite, but being... We were sitting there and we walked up the road together to have a coffee, and we both sat down and we were both a bit puffed. And it was just sort of, and I've been a little bit sick myself, and I've had some health issues. And we we sat down and said, oh, fuck, man, we'd better start looking after ourselves, basically. We don't want to have, because both of us have lost a few friends over recent years, and particularly this year. And we just commented that we'd seen each other at funerals and we didn't want to see each other at our own, you know, at each other's.
Yeah. And it is a big shock, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it shocked me. I mean, as I say, it was only a week before. We were sitting there talking. He addressed the last Whistleblowers Alliance meeting. He was talking to me about a campaign I'm trying to work up on the arms industry. That was the reason for our talk, was to bounce some ideas off him. He could. He was one of the people who could put his finger on a point, a pressure point of a campaign. I mean, the campaign I was talking to him about the last time I saw him was about the Avalon Air Show, which has basically become an arms trade fair over the last two or three shows. The arms trade fair is bigger than the actual air show. They don't even bother hiding the fact anymore. But, you know, over the years, you know, when I first got to Melbourne, I met up with some friends, Dave Kerrin and that, and we come up with this idea of Earthworker, the Union Green Caucus, and, of course, Bill was straight in that, and we're working on Earthworker, and while Bill and I are working on Earthworker, you know, the refugee and the Tampa thing is happening, and he's the delegate for the NTU at La Trobe University, and he's going out to rural areas and getting involved with Rural Australians for Refugees, which a lot of the people in the city in Melbourne had no idea of. While all that's happening again, the Second Intifada started. And so we, you know, it's Bill and I and a couple of others got together and reformed the Friends of Palestine. And, you know, it was quite... one funny story I've got was when we were sitting in a Friends of Palestine meeting, and this young bloke walked into the meeting, and we knew him, and he sat down, and after a while he looked around and he said, "Hang on," he said, "isn't this an Earthworker meeting?" And we said, no, "it's Friends of Palestine. Earthworker starts in an hour." And he looked around and it's like, "Well, you're all the same people." I said, "Not all of us, you know," but that's how it was. There was, you know, Bill, Dave Kerrin, David Spratt, a few others, Sol Salby, and some of them for a long time, I guess, from between 17 and a dozen years ago, formed the nexus of a whole lot of cross-sectorial groups. You know, we then got together and formed the Victorian Peace Network, and of course Bill was instrumental with us in organising the big rallies that we had where we basically shut Melbourne down. So again, that was the strength, whether it's working with Earthworker or the refugees or the Victorian Peace Movement Network, he was able to, he was broad enough and erudite enough to, you know, talk two people within their sectors about their sectorial concerns. He wouldn't be talking to rural Australians about problems. It's the same problems he'd be talking to city folk about. He wouldn't be talking to the Catholics about the same problems he'd be talking to the trots about. And he was able, because of his vast, broad knowledge base, to hit the nail on the head, as it were, with why you should be involved in this, which is often a totally different reason to why he should be involved in this. We never made a plan to meet each other again, but you just expect to ring him in a few weeks' time, and, yeah, I'll swing round on the way back from 3CR next week and have a cup of coffee, which is how it happened, just swinging round after he'd been at 3CR. So that was a shock, but on the other hand, I guess it's a wake-up call. Bill and I, and many of your listeners, no doubt, have lost a lot of people over the last few years. It's, you know, it's gets to the point, like I put on his Facebook page with the flag at Trades Hall at half mast. So many times you stood there under a half mast red flag for other people. This one's for you, Bill.
Reverend Paul, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Very sad to hear the news about Bill again. Bill volunteered his time on a Wednesday every week for the last 4 years, working at our church and volunteering, even though we didn't share the same ideologies. He was a great man, a good man, an incredible knowledge, very gifted, and would make networks wherever possible, find common conspirers together. So we've lost a good man, a good comrade, and we've also lost a good mate.
Yep, he said it all.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I think, yeah, everybody's feeling that we've lost a good mate, and also we've lost more than that, I think the labour movement, or you know, let's call it what Bill called it, because the labour movement's much too narrow, the progressive movement has lost a phenomenal man, a phenomenal voice, someone who was who really had an overview of how all those struggles were interlinked, both now, today, and through history. So if we just go back to our little story, so those two comments that we've just heard from Jacob and from the vicar at Springvale, really they were about Bill in, I suppose, more recent years, or, well, so before, just so in between where we left off the SPSF.
So he dusted himself off?
He dusted himself off. He got a job working at the Victoria University Student Union.
At La Trobe? Or was it
Victoria Central? University first, then he went to La Trobe.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And so, and politically, what happened was that, you know, we had our little group, and we called us, which we call Communist Intervention, which we called, we decided that, you know, we wanted to reclaim the word communist from Stalinist things, but I don't think we were ever successful about that. But anyway, that was our intention when we called ourselves communists, that we wanted to define communism as a good thing, not
common good, not
about
despotism.
Absolutely not about Stalinism. That's right. So, anyway, but when we were at the SPSF, the union, and the Kennett attacks were going on, we set up on the steps of Parliament House a tent embassy. Inspired by, of course, the Aboriginal tent embassy in Canberra, we thought, let's have a tent embassy outside Kennett for workers. And do you know, Bill supported that idea instantly and facilitated. I thought, what a wonderful idea, but I don't know that I would have had the capacity to actually make it happen. But Bill made it happen, and Bill. And at times, you know, the police would ring and they'd say, you've got to come and get rid of this thing. It's, you know, it's dirty, it's something. I don't know that. The police were actually quite good about it most of the time. But there were times when they'd complain and say, you've got to move it and you can bring it back tomorrow if you want. So Bill would, you know, would get out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and go down there to the tent embassy if there was some crisis. He'd look after it, remove it, and then would bring it back the next day or whatever. And, you know, it was a great thing to have that. Well, his presence was there for, I don't know, it must have been there for a couple of months.
Well, it strikes me that what you're saying is he wasn't just cerebral, he was actually practical.
Oh, he was incredibly practical.
He does what he said.
He was incredibly practical. I mean, one of the stories that I've been telling in the last week is just a very personal story, which is that I hadn't seen Bill for a few years for various reasons. You have a 30-year relationship with someone. There's a few years go by every now and then. And I bumped into him and it was immediately, oh, wow, terrific, let's catch up. And so he came round to my house, and before I knew where I was, he was repotting my tomatoes. He'd given me some soil enricher. He was replanning my garage because it's dark and he wanted to let light in. And he was ringing contractors saying, now, how much is it going to cost to do da, 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 and giving me quotes. And it was amazing. So that mind of his worked on every level, and that knowledge of his seemed to be there on every level. How the hell, I mean, I know he came from the country and his parents always grew veggies
country
and
boy.
Stuff.
Yeah.
But also
he knows how to grow tomatoes, for
no,
God's sake.
But not only that, he cared. I mean, you could know and sort of not care.
Oh, he cared. Oh, he cared. So the other thing that happened during that period was that Richmond, there were several schools that protested against closing, but there were two that, you know, had long, well, three actually, Fitzroy High and the Eastlands, the school at Eastlands. Northlands.
No, it's
Northlands, yeah. Northlands. Richmond Secondary College, and the Richmond Secondary College had an occupation that went for 12 months, and they asked us as a union to give them some sort of support, and we did. Bill in particular did.
Well, that was an absolutely ferocious campaign.
It was a ferocious campaign. Yeah. And as a result of that campaign and our working with them, we then decided that we would join together politically with
Steve Jolly.
An organisation called Militant at the time, of whom the leader was Steve Jolly at the time.
And which is interesting because Steve Jolly is going for Victorian Parliament in this next round in the Richmond seat.
Yes. Yeah, and I actually wish him absolutely all the best because I think
he should. We should put a plug in for the show because in weeks to come we've got an interview with Steve.
Terrific, because I think, he's shown himself as a Yarra councillor to be, you know, really terrific.
Equally and cerebral and practical.
I'm not sure, but...
Well, he's quite practical.
He's very good, Steve. He's really, really
anyway,
he's
good. Anyway, we're off the point. We're talking about Bill here.
Yeah, Bill treated him as a comrade, put it that way.
Yeah.
And so out of that came the idea that we would try one more time to organise a broad left organisation. And so we met together with other people who you know, were interested, and we established Progressive Labour Party.
PLP.
And that brought in, you know, a lot of people for a short time. There were a few hundred members. It was pretty phenomenal. And we had one of my most memorable political engagements was a camp. Again, you'll notice training. a camp that we had at Eureka up in the hills. It went for a whole weekend, and it was a whole weekend of workshops about all different, you know, aspects of trade union organising and political, you know, knowledge and understanding and development and strategy making and so on. And it was absolutely fantastic. Again, it didn't go anywhere. And I blame the times. You know, I just think that we've lived the last 30 years through a time where reaction has been so dominant that it's made it virtually impossible for the left to, you know, to develop and sustain large organisation. I sincerely hope, and it seems to me there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that is now turning around.
Well, at this point, we'll duck in and hear what Kevin's got to say about the week that was. Time is of an essence.
A week Solidarity Brekkie team listener, when there seemed to be the odd contradiction within the greatest little economic order of them all. Let's start with the They Never Listen to Themselves Award of the Week, hands down to state caring business class government economic guru Mike Hell to Workers Oh No Brain, attacking the Socialist Party for, he claims, making $629 million in election promises, the height or depth, depending which way we look at it, of irresponsibility. And what are you promising? I would expect to make about $600 million in election promises. He looked very pleased with himself. We await the Socialist Party's attack on that as irresponsible as the great ideological differences tear them apart. Mike Hell to Workers, your They Never Listen to Themselves Award is on the way. On the state spending on vital necessities, Tennis True Blue Aussie announced a record profit of $11.2 million. Net profit, I presume, and I raise this because we also presume they can make that record profit thanks to us, the public purse, funding multi-million more and more upgrades of its venue, where the elite gather every year for the social splash, the social bash that is the tennis racket. Charming, charming, cultured people, and isn't it lovely to see them using that venue so appropriately after years of the long-haired commie lots exploiting what was the Yarra Bank to preach their uncultured, uncharming rubbish, and the rabble rousing in the May Day March congregating to preach their agitprop, reducing the Yarra Bank to a philosophical backwater. Thank you, John Kane, working-class hero, for handing this site of working-class history to the real people who can enjoy it with class and dignity and charm. Uncharming, after these long-haired and short-haired commie, greeny, wooden-working and iron feminists got their oversensitive proverbials in a knot just because the caring business-class government's economic manny-man, Matthias Rottentuther, borrowed from that epitome of male sensitivity, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to describe Socialist Party Supremo and would-be Big Supremo Bill Shorten ambition as an economic girly man. Rottentuther responded brilliantly to the chorus of over-righteous over-sensitivity. For goodness sake, whatever happened to live and let live in this country, the basic right to upset a few people like anyone who can think, something Matthias clearly practiced before opening his mouth. Anyway, his brilliant response. Calling him an economic girly man was not in any way intended as a reflection on girls. It is entirely intended as a reflection on Bill Shorten ambition. Matthias, I'm not all that certain that actually explains it. Not sure you quite nailed it. Perhaps an explanation of how girly doesn't mean girly might have helped. Given the US of the UN of the US of the world's economic guru is a woman, we suppose she could be called an economic girly woman. And she was stirring up the, in this case, the rightly sensitive and righteous. See, Dr. Janet Yellen, the truth, addressed this conference in Boston and upset the poor Republicans by, they exploded, bringing politics into economics when she's supposed to be above politics and should just make decisions to assist the greatest little economic order of them all that government should keep out of. And they'll explain better than I can why there's no contradiction in all that. But Janet said, hope you're sitting down, listener, hope you're sitting down, she was greatly concerned by rising income and wealth inequality and asked whether it is compatible with American values. How dare she? And it gets worse. The past several decades have seen the most sustained rise in inequality since the 19th century. I think it is appropriate to ask whether this trend is compatible with values rooted in our nation's history, among them the high value Americans have traditionally placed on equality of opportunity. The rich got the best schools and the best teachers, she said. Any wonder the Republicans are screaming. How dare a public official suggest there's something wrong with inequality? How else can the rich get rich? We need an economic manny man in this position. Their one consolation would be that there's no risk the other lot, the other side of the coin, the Democrats, will do anything about it. They can stop shaking. But here also, this bringing politics into economics and economics into politics is a real problem. Take the real problem, our very own big supremo tiny a bit more for the boss's faces, as these irresponsible warmists, like his very, very, very close friend Barack for Change, 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 want to raise the little matter of climate change, which may or may not be climate change, at the G20. Climate change has no role at the G20 because the G20 is an economic forum, Tiny explains. And why do you oppose action on climate change? Because of its impact on the economy, which it has nothing to do. Exactly. See, consistency run riot. On which the Hayseed and Sheepshit Party wants the law changed to charge investment funds, including our market forces universities, under the secondary boycott provisions if they call for divestment in important industries like beautiful lifting the poor out of poverty coal. And you believe in their right to invest as they see fit? Certainly, absolutely, but we also believe in their non-right not to not invest. No contradiction there, whatever that meant. The government also denied that beautiful lifting the poor out of poverty coal was not a renewable source. It is a beautiful source of beautiful renewable profit. Back to our manny-man economic giant mind Matthias, a true believer in freedom, market forces, laissez-faire, all that represents freedom, the macho freedom of real men, not girly men. Well, the head of the True Blue Aussie Securities and Investments Con Mission Monday said True Blue Aussie was a paradise for white-collar criminals, who mostly just cop a slap on the wrist, and called for huge fines and harsher prison terms, suggesting fear of such penalties was the only way to deter greed, presuming apparently that greed plays a role when we know the corporate sector only exists to make life that little bit better for all of us. Well, next day, Matthias got on the phone demanding to know what he meant. Why would anyone say such a thing? Jail white-collar criminals. Which brings us to Wednesday, when the Con Mission head corrected his statement, which it seems had been misinterpreted by the media reporting what he actually said. I correct what I said, he said. Basically, the point is, we want to make sure we don't become a paradise. Oh, right, well, that clears that up, about as convincing as Matthias's explanation of the girly bit. So obviously, white-collar criminals get the book thrown at them if they're unlucky enough to be dragged before a court. Oh, and in case we were wondering, yes, the head, Greg Medcraft, is a residue of Socialist Party government appointments. Don't think we need a fortune teller or a crystal ball to predict his future. The cruel might suggest, but we certainly wouldn't, that all corporate boardrooms are 100% full of white-collar criminals. Finally, and seriously, two deaths this week. Our own Bill Deller and a former Socialist Party big supremo, who opposed the Socialist Party opposing the Vietnam War in the mid-60s, claiming it was electoral suicide, forget the principle, and became Big Supremo largely thanks to it in the early 70s. And there remains a huge cloud over his reaction to the Indonesia and other people's business invasion and oppression of Timor-Leste. Nonetheless, he did, by today's standards, do some pretty progressive things. One that hasn't been mentioned all week was in those first days of fringe activity, withdrawing South African Airlines landing rights in True Blue Aussie, a major move against apartheid in that period. And the media has been full of his life and death for the past few days. A parliamentary Democrat, capitalist reformer who looks positively revolutionary compared to today's ALP spineless non-entities. Not flooding the media, the real revolutionary, so give us Bill Della any day. OK, many of us thought he talked too much. He was the only interviewer I know whose guests apologised for interrupting him. But his content was intelligent and analytical, a capitalist opponent, a firm believer that capitalism cannot be reformed, must be overthrown. He threw himself enthusiastically into issues he saw advancing that cause. It's a cliche, but his voice and his politics, his analysis and that enthusiasm will be missed. And more particularly, we mourn Bill, our comrade and friend. Good
you
morning.
Won't go to purgatory, Bill, because you listen to so many whinging callers worrying about buildings, whether they got blown up or not, etc. So I guess you're going to have a one-way ticket to the better side of eternity, but you will always be with us. I don't wish to upset anybody there by being a bit emotional, but my partner was killed by his doctors 5 years ago, and in that time I lost everything. I've fought every government body you can name. I'm an expert on fighting these people. I missed your show Wednesday, Kevin, because I had to fight more people on another front. And I just say what helped me recover was listening to 3CR and listening to people who are intelligent, who know the truth and speak the truth. And thank God there are still some people in this country who do that. So I just want to say, Bill, I never knew you, but thank you for everything and thank you for helping me and pulling me out of the abyss on more than one occasion.
Well, there you go. That was an emotional call coming from Keep Left the other day. So Bill will be surely missed, but we've
it's
got
an amazing tribute, isn't it? To the fact, you know, someone who apparently didn't actually know Bill, knew him as a radio announcer and felt all the same things that all of those of us who knew him felt.
That's a warm human in him.
Yes,
all
exactly.
All is there. Now.